Due to the graphic nature of these crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of violence, domestic violence, drug abuse, and murder that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under the age of 13. In April of 1984, 69-year-old Marvin Gaye Sr. sat on a stiff cot with a tattered Bible open across his lap. He flipped through the torn, marked-up pages, searching for a legible verse. Most of the words were indecipherable. Marvin Sr. slammed the book shut and tossed it aside. He took a deep breath, like his court-appointed counselor had taught him. It was okay. It didn't matter that he couldn't read the verses. Just holding the Bible made him feel closer to God. Just then, a guard unlocked his cell door and ushered him out. It was time for his interview. Marvin Sr. was ushered into the visitor's area, where a nervous reporter introduced himself as a writer for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. Sitting behind a plastic window and speaking through a telephone, Marvin Sr. answered his questions. He asked about Marvin Sr.'s past as a preacher and his relationship with his son. Marvin Sr. sighed. He wished the reporter would just get to the point. They both knew what question the man wanted to ask, so Marvin saved him the trouble. He gripped the table in front of him, looked the reporter in the eye, and said, "I pulled the trigger." Hi, I'm Lainey Hobbs, and this is Crimes of Passion, a Parcast original. In the legal definition, a crime of passion is a violent crime that occurs in the throes of extreme emotion, leaving no time to reflect on the consequences. But in this show, we explore how passionate relationships sometimes lead us to criminal activity. How does a husband and wife become killer and victim, or killer and co-conspirator? If there's a thin line between love and hate, what manipulates our relationships into deadly results? You can find episodes of Crimes of Passion and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Crimes of Passion for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Crimes of Passion in the search bar. Last week, we discussed soul singer Marvin Gaye's relationship with his abusive father. No matter how famous Marvin became, he couldn't escape the feelings of inadequacy his father instilled in him. Eventually, Marvin became depressed and addicted to cocaine. In late 1983, the 44-year-old musician moved back in with his parents to try and get clean. But it was far from a healthy environment. On the morning of April 1, 1984, a final argument between Marvin and his father turned violent. This week, we'll talk about Marvin Gaye's untimely death, his father's attempts to justify the murder, and the complicated legacy Marvin left behind. We have all that and more coming up. Stay with us.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Elevate every morning with Tommy John's Second Skin Underwear. The luxurious support of Second Skin guarantees everything will go smoothly. With over 20 million pairs sold and thousands of five-star reviews, guys love Tommy John. Plus, your most valuable assets are covered with Tommy John's best pair you'll ever wear or its free guarantee. Get 20% off your first order at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. Save 20% at TommyJohn.com/Spotify. See site for details.
With Capella University's FlexPath format, you can set your own deadlines, learn at your pace, and access most coursework from anywhere at any time. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
On the morning of Sunday, April 1st, 1984, 44-year-old Marvin Gaye Jr. woke to the sound of his mother softly reading to him from the Bible. He was reminded of a passage from the book of Luke, chapter 23. Marvin knew the verses well. They were about forgiveness. He rubbed his eyes and rolled over in bed. He'd tried so many times to forgive his father and himself, but he just couldn't do it. He felt like a failure and a sinner. He knew that the moment his mother left his room, he'd dig into his stash of cocaine. Most days, he was too high to do anything. He just sat around, lying to himself that tomorrow would be different. But at least for a few precious moments in the morning, he could feel some peace listening to his mother read. But around 10 a.m., the quiet was shattered by Marvin's father, who was already drunk. Marvin Sr. yelled at his wife to come downstairs. Hearing the entitled edge in his tone as he ordered Alberta around made Marvin Jr.'s blood boil. For so long, Marvin had blamed himself for his failures, but all of a sudden, the real culprit became clear to him. It was his father. How could he be expected to build a proper life when his father had destroyed its foundation at every turn? In a fit of rage, Marvin Jr. shouted back, telling his father that if he had something to say, he ought to come upstairs and say it instead of screaming across the house. 70-year-old Marvin Sr. had no problem matching his son's fury. He stalked up the stairs and burst into the bedroom, his bloodshot eyes wide in anger. But before he could yell at his son, Marvin Jr. is said to have shoved him back into the hallway. Marvin Sr. was stunned. As a child, he had threatened to kill his son if he ever hit him back. If he were wearing a belt, he would have taken it off and whipped Marvin Jr. like a child. But he didn't need a weapon. He could beat his son just as easily with his bare hands. He raised his fist and raced forward. But Marvin Jr. had suffered with trauma for the last 40 years, and that day, he'd had enough. When his father lunged towards him, Marvin Jr. released 40 years of pent-up rage. He allegedly knocked Marvin Sr. to the ground, kicking, punching, and slapping him indiscriminately. He didn't even register the sound of his mother's screams. Marvin Jr. had faced decades of abuse, yet he had never seriously fought back against his father in a physical way. Whether it was the cocaine or simply the breaking of the tide after years of abuse, something snapped in Marvin that day. Before I continue with Marvin's psychology, please note, I am not a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist, but I have done a lot of research for the show. Childhood abuse has been linked to addiction in adulthood. In a 1999 study of 91 adults seeking treatment for cocaine addiction, psychologists Dr. Bonnie Dansky, Dr. Christina Byrne, and Dr. Kathleen Brady found that 85.7% of patients reported experiencing physical assault at some point in their lives. Nearly half of the patients met the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. In other words, victims of physical abuse like Marvin Gaye are more susceptible to developing a cocaine dependency. High doses of cocaine are, in turn, associated with heightened levels of aggression. In a study published in the Journal of Pharmacology, Biochemistry, and Behavior, Dr. Alice Licata found that subjects given higher doses of cocaine reacted more aggressively than placebo subjects, irrespective of level of provocation. The physical abuse Marvin suffered could have caused his future cocaine addiction, which then made him more vulnerable to sudden, violent outbursts. The rage he unleashed on his father had been brewing for decades, intensified by drug use and unresolved trauma. As Marvin Jr. pummeled his father, 71-year-old Alberta Gaye leapt up and pulled her son back by the shoulders. Marvin Sr. rolled onto his side, his stomach aching. Marvin Jr. stood in the hallway, panting and still full of energy. With her voice shaking, Alberta told her son to go back to his room. Marvin Jr. followed her command, sitting on the edge of his bed. Inside his room, he tried to steady his breathing. Blood dripped from one of his knuckles onto the comforter as his mother tried to calm him. He didn't regret it. His father deserved every blow. But still, there was a pit in his stomach. He'd always imagined that when he finally hit back, it would feel righteous, liberating. It didn't. Though he didn't have any sympathy for his father, he also didn't feel any better about himself. No matter how hard he kicked the old man in the gut, he was still the same. He was still powerless. He dug his nails into the sheets. He hadn't done anything right. He couldn't be a good son, a faithful husband, or a present father. He couldn't even get revenge the right way. Maybe the problem wasn't his father, after all. Marvin Jr.'s thoughts were interrupted by the reemergence of his father. He braced himself for a ruthless argument or a physical punishment. But that wouldn't change anything. It wasn't like his father could kick him out. He was the one who owned the house. He wiped his bloody knuckle on his pants and blinked the tears out of his eyes. When he looked at his father, Marvin Jr. thought he looked strangely stoic for a man who'd just been beaten. Before Marvin Jr. could say anything, his father raised a .38 caliber revolver, aimed, and pulled the trigger. The bullet felt like fire when it tore through Marvin Jr.'s heart. As his body slumped over, his father stepped forward and fired one more shot at point-blank range. Alberta moved closer to her son, but she was already too late. Alberta howled for God's mercy. She wanted to hold Marvin Jr. and breathe life back into his limp body, but her husband stood between them, and she was terrified Marvin Sr. would turn the gun on her next. Alberta crumpled to the floor. She could hardly walk, so she crawled down the staircase, all the while begging her husband not to shoot her. But Marvin Sr. had no intention of killing his wife. He calmly stepped over her and walked downstairs to the front porch. There, he sat down, tossed the revolver into the yard, and waited for law enforcement to arrive. Alberta Gay stumbled to the kitchen and called Los Angeles police. Between sobs, she told them there had been a murder. When officers arrived, they found Marvin Sr. still sitting on the porch with his hands up. He confessed to the shooting, but insisted he thought the revolver had been loaded with blanks. Marvin Sr. was hauled off to jail while his son was transported to California Hospital Medical Center. As the ambulance raced down the street, Alberta stood alone in a puddle of tears. Everything she'd ever loved was gone. At 1:01 p.m., 44-year-old Marvin Gay Jr. was pronounced dead on arrival. News of his passing spread around the globe like wildfire. Eulogies appeared on televisions and in newspapers and magazines in the United States, Europe, and Asia. But many of these tributes got Marvin all wrong. They portrayed him as a glamorous womanizer, with one going so far as to call him the idol of playboys everywhere. The image many people had of Marvin Gaye was highly romanticized. His confident, sexually charged lyrics hid his lifelong problems with intimacy. But it was undeniable that Marvin's music touched thousands of fans who grieved after his death as if he had been a family member. At his open casket viewing on April 5, 1984, over 10,000 people came to bid him a final farewell. The funeral was far smaller, with around 400 attendees. His ex-wives Anna and Janice, along with all three of Marvin's children, sat up front, as did Motown's founder, Berry Gordy. Alberta attended without her husband, as he was still in police custody. Instead, Alberta sat with her three remaining children, Jean, Ziola, and Frankie. None of them had spoken to Marvin Sr. since his arrest, and they didn't plan to ever again. What he'd done was unforgivable. Before the ceremony ended, Alberta spent a final moment beside her son. The funeral home had done a nice job preparing the body. All the anger and anguish that usually lined Marvin Jr.'s face had been smoothed away. That, at least, was a consolation. After a lifetime of struggling with his self-image, relationships, and drug abuse, Marvin Gaye was finally laid to rest. Unfortunately, the chaos of Marvin's life didn't disappear after his death. He left no will, so legal battles quickly ensued over the division of his estate and the ownership of his intellectual property. Berry Gordy wanted to make a movie about the singer's life, but offered Alberta and Marvin's children very little compensation for the rights. While trying to get her son's affairs in order, Alberta discovered that even with all his houses, cars, and other assets taken into account, Marvin Jr. still died with over $1 million in debt. Marvin Sr. sat in jail awaiting trial, and there was no way she could afford his $100,000 bail. Heartbroken and nearly penniless, Alberta and her children didn't know what to do, and things were only going to get more difficult. When we return, Marvin Sr. faces the court of public opinion before he ever gets to trial.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
New year, new credit scores. Chime makes it easier to build credit using your own money and on-time payments with the secure Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card. Use it everywhere Visa credit cards are accepted. To apply, just open a Chime checking account with a qualifying direct deposit. There's no annual fee or credit check required when applying. Get started at chime.com/build. That's chime.com/build. The Chime Credit Builder Visa Credit Card is issued by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Late payment may negatively impact your credit score. Results may vary.
Now, back to the story. After an argument escalated into a physical fight on April 1, 1984, 69-year-old Marvin Gaye Sr. shot his 44-year-old son dead at their home in Los Angeles. As his wife and remaining children were left to pick up the pieces, Marvin Sr.'s only concern was himself. On the day of his son's funeral, he met with his attorney to discuss the upcoming case. Marvin Sr. was adamant that he believed the gun had been loaded with blanks. It wasn't a very convincing claim. He couldn't provide a logical explanation as to why he thought the bullets weren't real. Marvin Sr.'s attorney believed his client was acting erratically, so he ordered both a psychological and medical examination. In late April 1984, an MRI revealed a problem, a walnut-sized tumor in the base of Marvin Sr.'s brain. It may have had an impact on his behavior and mental state. Psychiatric effects of brain tumors can vary widely. A 2019 pamphlet published by the American Brain Tumor Association contains a list of possible symptoms, which includes abusive behavior, violent behavior, impulsivity, rage, and delusion. It's possible that the tumor affected Marvin Sr.'s ability to reason. It could have significantly altered the way he responded to his son's aggression. Increased inclination towards rage and violence, along with impulsive decision-making, may have contributed to Marvin Sr.'s violent actions. And, as unlikely as it seems, delusion could have made him believe the gun wouldn't fire real bullets. In May, Marvin Sr. underwent surgery to remove the growth and was deemed psychologically competent to stand trial. He intended to plead not guilty by reason of self-defense. The court had some solid evidence to support his story. There were photos of the elderly man's injured torso, which had been badly bruised by his son's attack. While her husband awaited trial, 71-year-old Alberta Gaye struggled to come to terms with the destruction of her family. She and her remaining children had suffered a terrible tragedy at the hands of one of their own. The more Alberta turned over the events of April 1st in her mind, the more she saw her husband for what he was. The cruelty he displayed that day was part of a long-standing pattern of violent behavior. Ever since their children were toddlers, he'd beaten and berated them. He did the same thing to her.
She'd just been too scared to tell anyone. With her husband in jail, Alberta finally had the distance she needed to view their relationship objectively. Marvin Sr. was a harsh father and an unsupportive husband. He was cold and contemptuous, strange and secretive. When she thought back on her husband's past as a Pentecostal preacher, she didn't see a leader at the pulpit. She saw a hypocrite. But as much as Alberta sometimes wished she could dismiss her husband as a monster, he was more complicated than that. He could be tender and vulnerable. She remembered how he used to pick clothing out of her side of the closet and how happy he looked in her dresses. She never understood that side of him, but she wanted to. She didn't judge him for everything. In some ways, his cruelty grew from his own feelings of inadequacy. Still, her empathy could only stretch so far. She couldn't forgive Marvin Sr. for what he'd done to their son. She couldn't stand to look at him, much less call herself his wife. Their marriage lasted 49 years because she felt a sense of duty. Any genuine love they shared had evaporated long ago. On June 18, 1984, Alberta filed for divorce. She moved into an apartment in Hollywood with her oldest daughter, Jean, because she couldn't stay at the house anymore. In an interview conducted shortly after her move, Alberta said, "I'll never live there again because it's nothing but a tomb to me." 2 days later, feeling sorry for Marvin Sr., Alberta arranged to have him released from jail on a $30,000 bond. He went back to living in Los Angeles alone. According to Alberta, living in the house where he murdered his son didn't seem to bother Marvin Sr. She said, "His eyes were dry and he didn't express any regrets." Although Marvin Sr. may have seemed emotionally composed in front of Alberta, privately he was eaten up by anxiety. With his trial fast approaching, he drank nearly a fifth of vodka a day to keep his anxieties at bay. Marvin Sr. laid back in one of the reclining chairs in the living room and tried to stop his hands from shaking. For a moment, he thought he might vomit. He put a foot on the ground to steady himself. The walls were spinning, but he still recognized them. His son had bought the house for him and Alberta in 1973. Marvin Sr. had never particularly cared for the large foyer, the high ceilings, or the extra bedrooms. He missed their simple life in Washington, D.C. Los Angeles was supposed to be the city of angels, but ever since their family moved there, they had strayed further and further from God. His son had led him down the path to destruction. Marvin Sr. took another drink. He could almost see his son's face in the swirling ceiling, his wide smile, his deep brown eyes. Then the image twisted, the smile turned lopsided, the eyes crazed by cocaine. His son had been terrifying. Marvin Sr. struggled to sit up and took another gulp of vodka. He'd committed an unforgivable sin. The judge would send him to jail, of course, but he was much more afraid of God's judgment. Every day he awoke with a certainty that heaven was no longer in the cards for him. Marvin Sr.'s days of drinking alone were only ever interrupted by meetings with his lawyer. The evidence was stacked against him. If they were going to keep Marvin Sr. out of jail, they had to craft a stellar defense. After reviewing the photos of Marvin Sr.'s bruised torso, Judge Ronald George agreed to lessen his charge from murder to voluntary manslaughter. Still, even a manslaughter charge carried the possibility of more than a decade in prison. It seemed like every move Marvin Sr. made was wrong. Before being bailed out of jail, he was interviewed by the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. He told the reporter he pulled the trigger, but swore he thought the gun had been loaded with blanks. He insisted he never meant to kill his son and that he deeply regretted what happened. Yet, when the journalist asked Marvin Sr. if he ever loved his son, he responded cryptically, let's say that I didn't dislike him. The interview was followed by a flood of articles about Marvin Sr. and his son. Most of them focused on Marvin Jr.'s career, his emotional struggle stemming from his father's physical abuse, and the altercation that led to his death. Several reporters also mentioned Marvin Sr.'s tendency to dress in women's clothing and his unceremonious retirement from the Pentecostal church. Although numerous articles included Marvin Sr.'s apologies, they juxtaposed them with the strange comments he made during his Los Angeles Herald-Examiner interview. Almost none of them mentioned the brain tumor that may have affected his ability to reason. Public opinion turned sharply against Marvin Sr. Nearly 70 years old, he worried he would spend the rest of his life behind bars. On September 20, 1984, Marvin Sr. pleaded no contest to voluntary manslaughter, but continued to insist he only killed his son in self-defense. The photos of his torso, as well as a coroner's report that found traces of cocaine in Marvin Jr.'s blood, served as convincing evidence. Regardless of the years of abuse to which Marvin Sr. subjected all four of the children he had with Alberta, he successfully spun the story to make himself look like the ultimate victim. Contrary to his wife's statements about his lack of remorse, Marvin Sr. insisted his regret was killing him. He described the entire ordeal as a bad dream that he wished he could wake up from. His attorney, Michael Schiff, said, "No one on earth will suffer more than what my client has suffered." Watching Marvin Sr. play the victim infuriated many of Marvin Jr.'s fans, who mourned the iconic singer for months after his death. According to Dr. Richard Harris, a cognitive psychologist at Kansas State University, their feelings of grief were likely genuine. Harris has found that grieving a celebrity can be just as difficult as losing a loved one, especially when a figure is as iconic as Marvin Gaye was. Fans can feel a one-sided but nevertheless intense emotional bond. Harris explains that the death of a famous artist can be particularly challenging for fans because we don't have the social structures or support for grieving the loss of a media character. Many of Marvin Jr.'s fans didn't know how to process their feelings, so they lashed out at Marvin Sr. They saw him as a cold-blooded murderer and vilified him accordingly. But according to members of the Gaye family, things may not have been as clear-cut as they appeared. Some made statements that alluded to a more complicated situation, even speculating that Marvin Jr. purposefully provoked his own death. In an interview with Marvin Jr.'s biographer, Jean Gaye said, "I have no doubt that this is exactly how Marvin chose to die. This way, he accomplished three things. He put himself out of his misery. He brought relief to my mother by finally getting her husband out of her life. And he punished father by making certain that the rest of his life would be miserable. In his own way, my brother knew just what he was doing." Marvin Sr. always told his son that if he ever hit back, he would kill him. When Marvin Jr. swung at his father on that Sunday morning, he may have anticipated his father's retaliation. He knew full well that Marvin Sr. wouldn't shy away from violence. On the other hand, it's also possible that Marvin Jr. was too high on cocaine to care about the consequences of his actions. He may have also believed that his father's age would have prevented him from fighting back. Perhaps, deep down, Marvin Jr. couldn't believe his father hated him enough to follow through on his threats. But whether Marvin Jr. engineered his death or not, Marvin Sr. was ultimately the one responsible. And soon, he would face the consequences. Up next, Marvin Sr.'s fate is sealed.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, back to the story. In the months after fatally shooting his son, 69-year-old Marvin Gaye Sr. was a subject of harsh media scrutiny. News articles vilified him and fans of his son denounced him as a murderer. Many neglected to acknowledge that Marvin Sr. had recently undergone surgery to remove a brain tumor and was suffering from alcoholism and depression. His lawyer had successfully convinced the judge to drop his charges from murder to voluntary manslaughter, but the elderly man was still facing a sentence of up to 13 years in prison. When he arrived at his sentencing on November 2, 1984, Marvin Sr. looked frail and shaky. After hearing his defense and reviewing the photos of the defendant's bruised torso, Judge Gordon Ringer was sympathetic. Because of Marvin Sr.'s age and health problems, Ringer believed that imposing any kind of jail time on the defendant would be similar to imposing a death sentence. When describing the events that transpired on April 1st, Judge Ringer reportedly said, "The young man who died tragically provoked this incident, and it was all his fault." His message was strong and upsetting to many. Marvin Jr. was to be held accountable for his own murder. The judge ultimately decided Marvin Sr. would serve no prison time for the murder of his son. Instead, he was sentenced to just 5 years probation. Due to his age and poor financial circumstances, he wasn't even required to complete any community service or pay any fines. The only stipulation of his probation was that he undergo psychological counseling and that he could no longer be allowed to own firearms or purchase alcohol. On his way out of the courtroom, Marvin Sr. thanked the judge for his mercy. It was one of the last acts of kindness he would ever receive. Although he left the court a free man, Marvin Sr. carried the weight of his crime with him for the rest of his life. A retired minister, he prayed every day for forgiveness, but he knew he'd committed a deadly sin on that April morning. He turned to God for absolution. According to a 2011 analysis led by criminologist Shad Maruna, people who have served or are currently serving jail time may latch onto religion as a strategy for shame management. The analysis found that new or increased religious devotion creates a new social identity, imbues the experience of imprisonment with purpose and meaning, empowers the largely powerless prisoner, and provides the prisoner with a language and framework for forgiveness. Reconnecting with his religion likely helped Marvin Sr. latch onto his identity as a preacher, rather than defining himself by the crime he committed. He could think of his imprisonment as a time to reconnect with God and attempt to earn forgiveness. But even if God forgave Marvin Sr., it would be even more difficult for his family. His wife of nearly 50 years, Alberta, left him after the murder. Shortly after the trial, Marvin Sr. returned to the home his son had bought him. In a matter of months, his health deteriorated significantly. Soon, he was no longer able to live alone, but none of his children or grandchildren were willing to move in and care for him. In 1986, 71-year-old Marvin Sr. moved to a nursing home in Inglewood, California. Marvin Sr. stared at the yellowing wallpaper. It was peeling near the ceiling. The air smelled antiseptic, and the pork chops they served him for dinner had a ghastly gray tint. He hated this place. The nurses were nice enough, but there was just something awful about the atmosphere. It wasn't good for the spirit. Decay was everywhere. Marvin Sr. spent his day surrounded by other achy-boned people, all of them shuffling around like zombies, taking cupfuls of multicolored pills and falling asleep before sunset. In moments of weakness, he wished one of his children would come visit him, though he didn't deserve it. But even in his fleeting moments of strength, he knew he wouldn't be able to face them if they did. He turned away while a round-faced nurse cut his pork chop into pieces. His hands were too shaky to use a knife. When she was done, Marvin Sr. ate slowly, his eyes fixed on the place where the wall met the ceiling. He shook his head. Someone really should come fix that. While Marvin Sr. lived in Inglewood, the rest of the Gay family retreated from the limelight. Alberta did one interview shortly after her husband's sentencing, but avoided further media appearances. She died of bone cancer in May of 1987. The same year his mother passed away, Marvin Gay was posthumously inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Between 1984 and 1994, Motown re-released several of his albums, including What's Going On, Let's Get It On, Midnight Love, and Here, My Dear. In the early 1990s, music critic Dave Marsh declared Marvin's 1968 hit, I Heard It Through the Grapevine, the greatest song in rock history. On September 28, 1990, 6 years after his death, Marvin Gaye received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. In 1996, 13 years after he won the Grammy for Best Male R&B Vocal Performance, he was honored with the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. Although Marvin Jr. was gone, his legacy continued to shape the lives of his entire family. Marvin Sr. remained alienated from his wife and children. Sometime around 1995, he developed severe respiratory problems and was transferred to a different nursing home in Long Beach, California. He died of pneumonia-related complications in October of 1998, shortly after his 84th birthday, and 14 years after his son's death. Meanwhile, Marvin Jr.'s siblings tried to get control of the wild rumors swirling about their family and set the record straight. In 1999, Frankie Gaye wrote a memoir entitled Marvin Gaye, My Brother. Shortly after sending the manuscript out to prospective publishers in 2001, 60-year-old Frankie died of complications due to a heart attack. His memoir was released posthumously in 2003. Zeola, with some help from Gene, worked alongside director Bob Blackton to create My Brother Marvin, a documentary detailing the singer's life from his sister's perspective. Marvin III, Anna and Marvin Jr.'s adopted son, tried his hand at music in the mid-2010s, but didn't have the musical success his father did. He released a pop single called Can't Take My Eyes Off You in 2013 to poor reviews. The music video, which includes photographs of Marvin Jr., seems to be both a tribute to the legendary musician and an attempt by Marvin Gaye III to live up to his name. Because Marvin Jr. often chose drugs over his children, it's possible that Marvin III felt some of the same insecurity and inadequacy that his father struggled with and sought similar validation through music. In contrast, Nona Aisha, Marvin's only daughter, became a successful singer, model, and actress. Marvin's youngest son, Frankie Christian, led a crusade against pop artists Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams to defend his father. In 2013, he noticed that their hit, Blurred Lines, sounded a lot like his father's 1977 song, Gotta Give It Up. After a five-year legal battle, the court ruled that the two songs were so similar, it was impossible to assert Blurred Lines hadn't been plagiarized. In addition to a one-time payment of over $7 million, Marvin Gaye's estate was found to be entitled to 50% of all royalties from Blurred Lines forever. Although Marvin Gaye's finances had been a disaster when he passed away, his intellectual property and the legal battle over blurred lines left his family wealthier than they'd ever been before. Despite the many exposés and biographies published after Marvin Gaye's death, most of his fans saw only a fraction of his true identity when he performed on stage. Beneath his seemingly confident surface was a man driven mad by unresolved trauma, deep insecurity, and an inability to form long-lasting relationships. Marvin Gaye was a contradiction. He was a preacher's son and a sex symbol, a best-selling artist and a man crippled by debt. He was a victim of child abuse and eventually a victim of murder. But many who were close to Marvin Gaye wished to emphasize the many blessings he left behind, rather than the tragic aspects of his life. As a woman who worked with Marvin at Motown said, "He was an angel. He came, he did what he needed to do, and he left us a great musical legacy." Thanks again for tuning into Crimes of Passion. We'll be back Wednesday with another episode. You can find more episodes of Crimes of Passion and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Crimes of Passion for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker. To stream Crimes of Passion on Spotify, just open the app and type Crimes of Passion in the search bar. We'll see you next time when true love meets true crime. Crimes of Passion was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Trent Williamson, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Joshua Kern. This episode of Crimes of Passion was written by Karis Allen, with writing assistance by Abigail Cannon. I'm Lainey Hobbs.